Welcome to Onc Live On Air. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jacob Sands, MD, and Shaley Shaw, MD, about considerations for diagnosing and managing WEMS, particularly in the context of small cell lung cancer. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Sands and Shaw discussed LEM symptom identification, the importance of paraneoplastic panels for assessing neurologic dysfunction in patients with small cell lung cancer, the need for specific autoantibody testing, and what guidelines currently note as best practices for the diagnosis of this disease.
What are some of the key clinical symptoms that LEMS presents with within the context of small cell lung cancer?
Well, the tough thing is that the symptoms of LEMS are quite common in general anyway. And someone with small cell lung cancer, sometimes especially on the treatment, feeling some weakness, which is, I'd say, one of the more classic symptoms of LEMS is proximal muscle weakness. This is a common thing. Autonomic dysfunction. I'd say essentially when any kind of weird stuff that's going on neurologically without a good description for it, I would consider paraneoplastic syndromes associated with small cell lung cancer. That can be LEMS. It can be other paraneoplastic syndromes of non-small cell lung cancer. I'd say, you know, we're focusing our discussion on LEMS, but let's, I think from a workup standpoint, I think more broadly is, okay, neurologic dysfunction in someone with small cell lung cancer, these patients need to get a paraneoplastic panel to essentially work that up. I think, you know, this topic is always one that gives me a little chest pain, because when considering something like just proximal muscle weakness, like I said, that's actually quite common. So how many cases are we potentially missing by not doing workup because we're saying, well, they're on chemotherapy, and so this is why they're having symptoms? For many patients, that may be true. But for some of them, we know that there are these paraneoplastic syndromes, including LEMS.
Oh, I completely agree. It can be very challenging. And sometimes even for a neurologist, I think, to kind of recognize and identify some of these really, really subtle symptoms that can arise and really try to establish a diagnosis as quickly as possible. The proximal muscle weakness is really kind of the key component or key symptom of the disease. And you can potentially ask very specific questions like, is it becoming increasingly difficult to walk upstairs or, for example, comb your hair, reach up, grab things from cabinets? Sometimes that can help define more proximal versus kind of diffuse weakness related to getting chemo and overall feeling unwell. The autonomic symptoms are also a prominent component. And I think there, the question to ask is if there's any new dry eyes, sometimes dry mouth, and then for men, oftentimes new erectile dysfunction. If we can kind of remember to ask those questions, that can also be a clue to this in particular. And then I think this one is actually a little bit easier for anybody to recognize: any new oculobulbar symptoms, right? Any new double vision, trouble with speech, swallowing, that's obviously going to raise red flags for a new neurologic disease. And LEMS is just one of them.
Looking at the oncology paradigm really broadly, what specific cancers are LEMS most likely to be associated with, sort of one over the other, do you, in your sort of experience?
Yeah. So LEMS is generally speaking associated with small cell lung cancer. And many of our paraneoplastic neurologic syndromes in general are associated with small cell lung cancer. And if not, typically a neuroendocrine or tumor that has some neuroendocrine cells or component to it. And so that's why oftentimes you'll see paraneoplastic neurologic syndromes associated with thymic tumors or germ cell tumors. With LEMS, non-small cell lung cancer has also been associated with it, as well as, like I said, thymic tumors. There are a couple cancers that, you know, have been identified at the same time, but whether they're truly relevant, like prostate cancers, is really kind of not clear. In general, we don't think of prostate cancers as being associated with LEMS. I will also say that in children, which is very rare, neuroblastomas have been associated with LEMS.
In the prostate cancer cases, is that small cell prostate?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's almost always when it's been described, it's very rare. And I think it's been just like your adeno, I believe. Is that right? That's your most common.
Yeah, that's the most common. But there can be a small cell transformation.
Yeah, you kind of wonder if maybe there is, you know, some component in there that's being missed. But in general, it's been adeno. And that's where I kind of say that we don't classically associate prostate cancers with perineoplastic syndromes. Like in our own neurologic criteria, we don't categorize them as like a high-risk cancer.
I see. I'd have to look this up, but I would think that if something like that is showing up, that'd be another reason to consider biopsy and looking for small cell transformation. But I'm not sure the actual numbers on that.
But there have been associations with small cell, like with the cervix, as you know, in LEM. So maybe that's kind of something analogous.
Yeah.
What specific guidelines are in place right now in terms of screening for LEMs?
The NCCN guidelines have now been updated to include some information about how to diagnose LEMS. I think the biggest things that come up are recognizing the proximal weakness and the autonomic dysfunction. From a diagnostic perspective, the typical way by which to do that is, especially as a neurologist, is to start with a perineoplastic panel, or alternatively, really specific autoantibody testing for Lambert-Eaton. So specifically the PQ type calcium channel antibodies, sometimes the N type. I will tell you that those are a little bit less specific. And so in general, though, the presence of those antibodies can be a clue. You just have to really kind of be very careful when you're really suspicious in doing those in isolation. I think at that point you want to start engaging a neurologist, and you also want to consider doing electrodiagnostic studies like a nerve conduction study specifically.
Well, as a medical oncologist, I think this is a space where I feel like it's important for me to identify patients, to identify patients for perineoplastic panel testing, and identify patients in which I need neurology assistance. And there's a lot of overlap there. I'd say in patients that I see them and I say, wow, you've got proximal muscle weakness, which as I've described is a very common thing. So proximal muscle weakness, my suspicion is not actually high, but I don't ever want to miss cases. So I'm going to send testing, but when that comes back negative, I'm comfortable with where things are and let's keep monitoring, versus cases where something is going on and I'm going to send perineoplastic panel testing, but whether that's positive or negative, I need neurology assistance. And you know, sometimes neurology weighs in and says, ultimately, there's nothing particularly neurologic going on. There's something else. And so then, you know, they're not necessarily following the neurology, but I'm going to need their input. And so those are two categories. I think the big thing for medical oncology is just identifying patients where we need to look further and making sure that we're not missing something. Now, within the NCCN guidelines, there is now mention of LEMS and testing. But I think it's important to put this in broader context. We have to be careful that we're not just so focused on not missing LEMS that we end up missing other perineoplastic neurological disorders. And so for patients that I see where I'm concerned, I just send a panel.
Anything else you'd like to address regarding the treatment considerations for clinicians?
Yeah, so there is an FDA-approved drug for the treatment of Lambert-Eaton, and that is amifampridine, commercially known as FIRDAPSE, which is a potassium channel blocker that is actually, generally speaking, really well tolerated and has shown benefit as a sort of a first-line treatment for patients who have LEMS. Typically, this is a medication that is given either in isolation, if a patient has mild enough symptoms and is able to respond to that alone, and sometimes is also given in conjunction with additional immunosuppressive treatments like steroids, for example. In general, amifampridine can be kind of enough for most patients, particularly when first diagnosed. And so I think that while most of the time it's a neurologist who's managing these drugs, it may be okay for an oncologist, particularly a community oncologist, who may not be able to have access to a neurologist on the same day or same week, to potentially start these medications until the patient can get in to see a neurologist for additional escalation. I think that it's, like I said, a pretty well-tolerated drug. Patients generally don't have any major side effects. There's very few interactions or concerns with it. And the dosing is relatively straightforward. And typically the company the company that makes it is readily helping with kind of the prescription itself. And so, like, you can ask for guidance from them. Now, it usually starts at 3 times a day dosing, like 10 to 20 to 25 milligrams a day. And you can kind of up titrate slowly so that you can see if the patient is tolerating it okay. But again, you know, it's a relatively straightforward medicine. I think it's totally reasonable if a medical oncologist wanted to try to start prescribing that before the patient got to a neurologist. And I know that from there, it can be a little bit more challenging to kind of identify when you need to escalate to additional treatment.
Those of us on the NCCN guidelines panel are really at some of the bigger academic centers, and so we lean quite a bit on neurology. But, you know, we recognize that there's a need to have information out there for oncologists in the community that don't have an immediately available neurologist to them, to have some guidance around the testing. First and foremost is an awareness of one, just making the diagnosis. I think Dr. Shah's input is really important. I know community oncologists are managing so much, and so to have some guidance and some reassurance about starting a drug is wonderful. And you know, that's being said, that I'm in a larger center where I have a neurologist kind of almost next to me in clinic that I can lean over to and get some guidance. And so this is where there is kind of a challenge then in providing any real guidance in the setting where I have a neurologist with me. So, but I think Dr. Shah's input is important for a medical oncologist to then hear and have some reassurance about.
I would probably just echo what Dr. Sand said about how the role of the medical oncologist is to really kind of identify patients that need to be tested, and from there, engaging with neurologists if your suspicion is high enough that something is going on that's not just related to their cancer.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.